The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
And that on the whole, it is better to put AI security within the broader context of cybersecurity.
I'm Stephanie Pell, senior editor at Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare podcast, May 3rd, 2023. Risks associated with the rapid development and deployment of artificial intelligence are getting the attention of lawmakers. But one issue that may not be getting adequate attention by policymakers or by the AI research and cybersecurity communities is the vulnerability of many AI-based systems to adversarial attack. A new Stanford and Georgetown report, Adversarial Machine Learning and Cybersecurity, Risks, Challenges, and Legal Implications, offers a stark reminder that security risks for AI-based systems are real and recommends actions that developers and policymakers can take to address the issues. I sat down with two of the report's authors, Jim Dempsey, Senior Policy Advisor for the Program on Geopolitics, Technology, and Governance at the Stanford Cyber Policy Center, and Jonathan Spring, Cybersecurity Specialist at the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA. We talked about how AI-based systems are vulnerable to attack, the similarities and differences between vulnerabilities in AI-based systems and traditional software vulnerabilities, and how some of the challenges and problems with AI security may be social as much as they are technological. It's the Lawfare podcast, May 3rd. Jim Dempsey and Jonathan Spring on adversarial machine learning and cybersecurity. One of our guests today, Jonathan Spring, is currently a cybersecurity specialist at CISA, but his participation in the workshop that led to the report predated his time at CISA. The views he expresses today are his views and don't necessarily reflect the views of CISA or the U.S. government.
I'd like to start by having you talk about why this report was written. What are some of the concerns surrounding the vulnerability of many AI-based systems to adversarial attack?
Stephanie, it's Jim. I'll jump in on that. I started getting into this issue back in 2021. I focus in my work on cybersecurity policy. Back when I started looking at this issue, I was familiar with the bias issues around AI. I was familiar with the mistakes in facial recognition, et cetera. But I hadn't looked at it from the adversarial perspective. That is, what happens if somebody intentionally tries to attack a system? And working with Andy Grotto at the Cyber Policy Center at Stanford, we started taking a look and looking at the technical literature written, in fact, by Jono and others. And I was astonished. I was really surprised to find out how remarkably fragile a lot of AI models are, particularly AI based upon machine learning techniques, which we're now, of course, increasingly familiar with given the emergence of ChatGPT and the other open AI products. But it turns out that an adversary can readily fool, particularly the classifier systems, image recognition or voice recognition systems, completely fool them into misreading the input. So a stop sign along the road marked with a few pieces of graffiti, the machine will read it as speed limit 45. That was a Berkeley study. Lots of studies showing how easy it was to fool image classifiers, that you present it with what to the human eye looks like one image and the machine completely misreads it because of data imperceptibly hidden in the image. And this has profound implications, obviously, as AI is becoming woven into so much of our governmental, commercial, personal tools that we're obviously dependent upon. And Andy and I wrote a paper looking at this from a policy perspective and how should the cybersecurity policy and AI policy governance development, how should it address this security issue? Meanwhile, Jono and others had been writing about this from a technical standpoint. And folks at Georgetown, particularly Andrew Lone, had been also writing on AI security from a policy perspective. And so we decided last year to sort of pool our efforts and to bring together a workshop. We'll talk a little bit more about the composition of who, some remarkable group that we brought together. But the idea was, let's dig deeper. Let's keep this discussion going. Let's keep refining our thinking around how to understand, how to describe, and then how to address the vulnerability of these AI, particularly machine-based systems.
Jono, do you have additional thoughts to add at this point about the vulnerability of many AI-based systems to adversarial attack?
Sure, Stephanie, thanks. And thanks for hosting us. Thanks, Jim, for working with us on this. It's been a real pleasure to work with such a great policy expert. I'm more of a traditional cybersecurity practitioner, vulnerability management, network forensics, that sort of a thing. From that perspective, you know, why we wrote the report is to do with a couple of things. So, of course, when managing risks, managing vulnerabilities, it matters if the systems are important. AI systems are clearly important in the world right now. At the same time, AI systems are software systems. And we know from lots of different aspects of computer science, cybersecurity practice, incident response, that all software has vulnerabilities. We don't expect the software systems that are AI systems to be any different. But at the same time, my experience and my understanding is that the machine learning engineering and the AI engineering communities, while very sophisticated, are not well connected to the security operations community. And so I think that this report highlights some of those connection issues, right? One of the things in the report is these social connections are very important. And in my work around vulnerability management, that is also like ends up being a lot of the importance, communication, similar language, similar expectations. And this is a complicated area. It's important that we got such a large number of experts to come together and share their different expertise and make those connections. But that was what was important about the report to me.
So I'd like to talk then a little bit more about the workshop and the folks that were involved in it. Both of you are listed on the report as workshop organizers. Can you talk a little bit about the workshop process and the multidisciplinary group of participants that came together for both the workshop and for the report writing?
Well, for me, one thing that was important was that we needed to get, and we did get, at the table, industry people, people who are actually building the technology and who are supporters, believers in the technology, but who recognize as well these security issues. And I wanted to get government people there. So, you know, my traditional approach on approaching any issue is I'm currently in an academic setting, but I really, really want to know what's happening on the ground. And so in putting this together, you know, we had myself as a lawyer, Andrew Lone, I think he's not a lawyer, but a policy person, Jono from the technical side. We had Ram Shankar Siva Kumar from Microsoft, And then we brought in a mix of others, lawyers, government folks, someone from MITRE, someone from NVIDIA, someone from DeepMind, someone who at the time was at Twitter, folks in the Department of Defense. So to my mind, remarkably and very deep and broad set of perspectives on the problem, because the first question I asked at the workshop actually was, is this just hypothetical? Is this just an academic concern? Most of the proof of vulnerabilities had been in university academic research. There's per day, there are multiple articles being published. Someone keeps a running tab of these. Per day, there are multiple articles published on AI vulnerabilities. And I asked, is this just hypothetical? Is this just, you know, in the lab? And everybody agreed, no, this is real. This is going to start appearing in the real world, and the time now is to start addressing it. And to me, that was one of the most significant takeaways from the whole workshop, which was this is real. And by the way, the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence, they basically came to the same conclusion, and others have come to the same conclusion that this is not just a bunch of academic studies. This is real.
So I was very glad to see that in the introduction to the report, you all defined some key terms. And to aid our discussion today, can you tell us what is meant by, for example, AI, AI system, and AI vulnerability? How is the report defining those terms?
Sure, Stephanie. I think definitions are really important. I mean, to some extent, that's my sort of academic background coming through. And I definitely struggled a lot with how we wanted to define, especially the different vulnerability terms. As much as possible for definition of AI, we leaned on existing definitions because we didn't want to sort of make a new one when other ones were adequate. So we talk about AI as generally machine learning systems or machine learning technology that is used to perform tasks that people consider to be traditionally performed by humans. I understand that there's some fuzziness with that, but that's the general gist there. An AI system is any system that's using one of these models as some sort of important component. And so obviously it's a giant software system with a bunch of different parts, maybe a cyber physical system, sensors, etc. But something that is using one of these statistical models built with machine learning methods. You know, a vulnerability in cybersecurity and information security is defined quite broadly on purpose, right? Because software systems are quite broad. They include cyber physical systems already and so on. But so in general, a vulnerability in a software system is just any set of conditions or behaviors that allows for the violation of an explicit or an implicit security policy. I mean, security policy might sound a bit jargon here, but it just means the set of things that are allowed to happen by whom, right? Implicit is an important qualifier there because for various technical reasons, but also various social reasons, we can't totally enumerate the list of who could do what that's allowed, right? It would be impossible to list that whole thing. So sometimes you find out the security policy has been violated because someone is able to do something that you didn't expect them to do, but you hadn't written that down yet. So an AI vulnerability is just any cybersecurity vulnerability in an AI system. Because we don't really need to change that vulnerability definition to make it apply to these cyber-physical systems or complicated machine learning systems that use an AI model as part of their software.
Stephanie, implicit in all of what, or explicit in all of what Jonna was saying is, we placed AI within the broader context of software cybersecurity. That certainly in the report that Andy and I did in 2021, we said it would be a big mistake to think that you have cybersecurity over in one vertical and then you have AI security over in another vertical, and somehow you have to reinvent or redefine or reimagine security for AI. As Jonna said, AI models, AI products are software, And we have a framework, or it's still evolving, but a framework for cybersecurity. And that on the whole, we'll talk about some of the differences, but on the whole, it is better to put AI security within the broader context of cybersecurity.
And I would note, before we continue, that the report also defines a high-risk AI system. Can you tell us how that term is used?
So thanks, Stephanie, for pointing that out. A high-risk AI system is certainly an important subset of AI systems to talk about. The general way that we talked about that at the workshop and that the readout talks about this is that any AI system, right? So any software system that uses a machine learning model, et cetera, like we just said, that is intended to automate or influence some important or socially sensitive decision, right? So certainly you see things that affect housing decisions, credit, employment, healthcare. Those systems have an outsized impact on human well-being, human safety, right? And we just wanted to call those out as particularly important systems to be aware of. You know, as we note in the report, there is focus on those systems from a fairness perspective, and we wanted to highlight the overlap in both intent and impact that, you know, those are high risk for fairness discussions that are important to pay attention to. They're also important to pay attention to from any sort of security perspective. You know, of course, fairness and security are not really separable from a technical perspective. And so that's the sort of system that we are talking about as a high-risk system.
At the beginning of the report, the authors note that although the repertoire of attacks studied by adversarial machine learning researchers is expanding, many of these attacks are still focused on lab settings, and a holistic understanding of vulnerabilities in deployed systems is lacking. So while the workshop participants generally shied away from suggesting a need to impose sweeping regulatory changes, everyone agreed that the risk of attacks on AI systems is likely to grow over time, and thus it's important to begin developing mechanisms for addressing AI vulnerabilities now. And a large portion of the report is thus a set of recommendations in four parts, and I want to talk to you about each of these parts. But before we do, I'd like to talk about an observation also made at the beginning of the report. And it is that at a high level, we emphasize that although adversarial machine learning is a complex field with highly technical tools, the problems posed by AI vulnerabilities may be as much social as they are technological. Can you give us some greater insight into this observation?
Well, I think the first element of that is awareness. And we see it now, actually, with this phenomenally rapid rush to deploy in a wide range of contexts the tools and products developed by OpenAI. And you've just seen, you know, announcement after announcement after announcement in the past 3 or 4 months since November of last year of new inclusion in Bing and now inclusion in 365, Microsoft 365, and the Open AI API, which is allowing many, many companies to use this, et cetera, et cetera. And the first sort of social hurdle or social issue is, are people adopting these systems really aware of the vulnerabilities that they may be taking on board? And with the pressure, the sort of competitive pressure, the business pressure, market pressure to utilize AI more and more, you know, faster, cheaper, better, are companies, developers, product managers, executives even aware fully of the risks that are entailed with these systems? And I think our shared conclusion was no, all too often they are not aware of the risks. And do they have systems in place to mitigate those risks, to identify them and mitigate them? No, too often they don't. Those are cultural issues, corporate cultural issues. They are social issues. They're not technological issues, and they're not really legal issues either.
I'd like to highlight another layer, which this might not be obvious to all of the listeners here. So I think that the coordinated vulnerability disclosure process, vulnerability management, those organizational functions sit pretty squarely in cybersecurity. And because of that, I think people think that they are wholly technical enterprises. And while we do use, you know, our own jargon, it is technical, it is about what the computers are doing or what can be done to them. Coordinated vulnerability disclosure is a social process for how the technical people share information in a timely manner with the right people, excluding the wrong people, so that the computers can be remediated, mitigated, the problems can be fixed. The problem that we're facing with AI engineering and communicating problems with adversarial machine learning is very similar, right? It is a very technical problem. There are very important technical details. It has to be discussed in technical jargon in order to get fixes completed. But if there's a fix available and no one who operates the system knows that they have a problem, that they need to fix it, that the fix is available, it certainly won't get deployed. So this is a social problem at many levels. It's not just a sort of policy or social, like sort of societal problem within a technical underpinning. There are various ways in which this is an importantly human-to-human problem and not just, you know, at some point you get deep enough into the machine and then it just becomes technical and you don't have to worry about people anymore.
The first set of recommendations that is discussed in the report surrounds the topic of extending traditional cybersecurity for AI vulnerabilities. And Jim, you touched upon this a bit, but it's worth asking, are attacks on AI systems new? And what kinds of attacks are likely to grow, do you think?
So you're right. At some level, they're not new. Certainly when you think about spam filtering, for example, you could argue that for quite a while now, spam filtering has had elements of artificial intelligence to it. At least it's been algorithmically, probabilistically based. And for as long as defenders have been doing spam filtering, malicious actors have been working to evade spam filters. And, you know, that's part of the landscape, part of the cybersecurity landscape now. Our conclusion at the workshop, and to me, it was a very interesting point. And in fact, I think it was Jono who made it. Where we are going to see the deployment of adversarial AI is in the areas specifically where there is either money to be made, as there is in spam filter evasion, or where there is nation-state interests at stake. So the attackers, in order to turn to AI as a vector of attack, and obviously on many systems there are many vectors of attack, we will see an increase in AI attacks where there is either a monetization opportunity or where there's a nation-state attacker opportunity. And you have to worry, obviously, and the DoD, the Department of Defense, is clearly worried about weapon systems, which are, you know, becoming increasingly interwoven with multiple AI-based systems. That's an area of high, obviously, high criticality and high payoff for the adversary who successfully compromises the AI-based systems of its opponent.
Jim summarized that quite well, right? There's both this aspect of there's nothing new under the sun, everything has some sort of way you can connect it. And also, things are importantly different because the world has changed, the situation has changed. I think it's important to connect with that machine learning systems are not new per se. As Jim pointed out, there's been machine learning for web search, spam filtering for going on 20 years, at least, if not more. And for as long as those systems have been deployed, people have been trying to abuse them, misuse them, subvert them, get around them. And at the same time, those were systems that in the context of coordinated vulnerability disclosure, we wouldn't normally need to do coordinated vulnerability disclosure, because if one organization owns the one mail processing center with the one spam filter, then if they have a problem, they know about it and they find it and they fix it. And we don't need to publicize that in the same way in order to get that problem addressed. There are definitely nuances to that that we're glossing over here about how, you know, attacks tend to target multiple different organizations that do similar things and so on. But what's happening, I think, with the explosion in sort of AI engineering, ML engineering, where people are better able to publish an open model, some other organization might take it in, use it, adapt it, transfer the learning, change it to a slightly different context, right? You end up with a lot of essentially supply chain problems that then lead to the need for better communication, coordination, cybersecurity processes. These are not that different from that when you use open source software that uses, say, some particular logging process, which shall not be named, that you might end up with some problems down the line because you've imported some sort of vulnerability you weren't aware of at the time you imported the software from someone else. So I think that's one of the key aspects that makes this more pressing presently from a cybersecurity, information security perspective, this increased complexity in the supply chain for production and use of machine learning models creates a pressure for better communication that was not there in the same way that it is now.
That supply chain point is huge. We look at SolarWinds and what a remarkable attack that was, both in terms of the technology behind it as well as the breadth of it. And I think there are you thinking about using the supply chain lens to look at AI vulnerability, I think is critical. So I just want to pound on that point.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you
that they don't have my life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
So then you have, you know, emphasized some of the similarity in thinking through AI vulnerabilities and traditional software vulnerabilities. But are there important places that you'd like to talk about where they might differ?
Thanks, Stephanie. I mean, one of the places that we talked at the workshop about important differences that really sort of surfaced up and rose to a consensus is the difference in the importance of the data to the outcomes, both in that, you know, training data, if it's manipulated, can obviously influence what the model becomes. And also these other kinds of attacks where you can potentially infer what data was used to train a model if you have access to the model, or even just the ability to query it, you can sometimes reconstruct the data set. So what that means for adequate privacy protections is quite complicated, given that the design of a machine learning model is to embed statistical facts about the data into the model so that it can be used to make inferences. And also how the data being central to the development process changes software engineering, which normally doesn't have to have unit tests and these sort of technical things that people use to ensure robust and repeatable engineering processes. It's not entirely clear how to extend that to data in the first place, and then the security implications of that is complicated. It's not that traditional software systems don't have data inputs, but the importance in an AI system is just bigger than it is for many traditional software systems. Jim, do you have other aspects that you'd like to sort of talk about the differences?
Well, I think another big, that's such an important one, but I think another major difference is so much of vulnerability management in the traditional software world is based upon the patch to fix model. That is, bugs are identified. If you have a coordinated vulnerability disclosure system and it's being followed, the bug is reported to the software developer confidentially, leaving enough time for the developer to adopt and push a patch. Of course, the minute the patch is pushed, then the bad guys, if they haven't already known about the vulnerability become aware of it. But if everybody is good at patching, which not everybody is, obviously, but you can get the vulnerability fixed. So the traditional vulnerability management cycle is based upon the fact that the vulnerability is fixable. But in the AI context, some of these flaws, to some extent, are inherent in the nature of the technology. And, you know, our definition, almost everybody's definition of artificial intelligence is a set of technologies that enable computers to learn to perform tasks traditionally performed by humans. But the critical point to appreciate here is that AI does not do those tasks the way a human would, and that the AI functions fundamentally differently in some ways from the human brain. Even though we talk about neural networks, the neural networks in AI don't actually work like the neural networks in the brain, et cetera, et cetera. And the flaws are to some, the vulnerabilities are to some extent the result of this interaction between the training data and the algorithm. Of course, if your training data is poisoned, you're cooked. But even if your training data is pure, still these problems can arise and can be identified and discerned by an attacker, and they may not be patchable, which then pushes the deployer of the system to the other part of vulnerability management, which is not to fix the vulnerability, but figuring out how to live with it and how to mitigate it rather than remediate it. So that's a big difference, and we have to acknowledge that. Even those of us like myself who say, look at AI through the lens of cybersecurity and take all of your existing cybersecurity structures and policies and make sure that you apply them to AI and don't let the sort of AI developers be over there in their own little bubble, but force the integration of your cybersecurity governance structure with your AI governance structure. Absolutely. I still believe that's the way to address AI vulnerability within the context of existing cybersecurity frameworks. But you do have to acknowledge that there is this very different nature, which dictates some different trade-offs in the sort of cost-benefit analysis. Because sometimes the only way to get rid of the vulnerability is to tear the whole damn thing out and build it all over again, which can be highly disruptive because it's the AI has become interwoven with so many other functions inside of an organization.
I found that to be a really interesting observation. Jono, did you want to add?
Stephanie, I would like to. I mean, I was a little bit of the sort of terminology task driver for this. And so Jim might be, you know, having some flashbacks about being annoyed at me. But the traditional in traditional software vulnerability management is doing more work than people might expect. So traditional for workshop participants really meant desktops, phones, servers. Right? There's a whole other breadth of cybersecurity that is industrial control systems, cyber physical robots, medical systems, all of these other things that are also non-traditional cybersecurity systems are also not actually very well integrated into the mainstream of cybersecurity operations and have some similarities with some of these things. So I just wanted to point out that cybersecurity maybe doesn't have the best tools for the sort of safety engineering that Jim is talking about. For making sure that the system is resilient and robust and doing the mitigations and making sure they're in the ability to do those is designed in from the beginning ahead of time. But some of the safety engineering folks in industrial control systems and so on have that expertise, and cybersecurity is working to bring that in and integrate that. And I wonder, and I don't think that the workshop had a complete answer here because we just, you know, there's so much to talk about, but just a flag for folks that there's within all of these, within the ML engineering community, within the policy community, within the cybersecurity community, of course, there's different subgroups that might not all be able to be in contact. And I'm interested to some extent in, you know, how much the AI vulnerabilities are not the same as traditional cybersecurity vulnerabilities, but might have interesting similarities with other non-traditional cybersecurity vulnerabilities, but we weren't totally able to explore that in the paper. But I think it's flagged there in the definition of what we count as a traditional cybersecurity vulnerability.
So notwithstanding all of these challenges, the report does make some recommendations with respect to addressing vulnerabilities in AI systems. Can you talk about some of those recommendations?
That's a great question about the different recommendations. There's four broad categories of recommendation and some smaller details in there, but the high level, it's extending traditional cybersecurity for AI vulnerabilities, improving information sharing and organizational security mindsets, clarifying the legal status of AI vulnerabilities, and supporting effective research to improve AI security. Are any of those that you'd like to talk about in some more detail?
I think the fourth one is quite interesting to me.
So there are at least three parts, and of course the workshop is not exhaustive, but these are three things that the workshop participants flagged as important to supporting effective research to improve AI security. So improving the collaboration between adversarial machine learning researchers and cybersecurity practitioners. Public efforts to promote AI research should emphasize AI security, including potentially some funding or increased funding for open source tooling that can promote more secure AI development. And finally, that policymakers should move beyond simple standards writing towards providing test beds or enabling audits for assessing the security of AI models.
Jim, did you have a favorite recommendation?
Well, you know, as I always say, I'm a lawyer, not a technologist. So we spent considerable time at the workshop talking about the legal framework. And at the end of the day, we adopted the sort of, you know, I don't know, legal precautionary principle of let's do nothing for now. And again, it fit with the overall theme of the workshop and the report, which is we have a lot of processes, we have a lot of governance structures, let's make them work. Or in the case of information sharing, we know how to do information sharing. Let's make information sharing work in the context of discussions company to company, peer to peer around vulnerabilities. But in the legal context, you know, high-risk systems, we define, among other things, to focus on those systems that make decisions about people, employment, credit, housing. And we have laws on all of those that prohibit discrimination, and the Federal Trade Commission, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the Department of Justice, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau have all issued guidance. The New York State Commissioner for Insurance has issued guidance. All of them basically saying the use of AI-based systems to make decisions about who to hire, about who to rent an apartment to, about who to give a loan to. Those decisions are all covered by existing law. And of course, in all of those areas, algorithms have been used for a long time. I mean, your FICO score is determined by an algorithm. And in all of those cases, the regulators, the enforcers of those laws have said, just because it's got the label AI slapped onto it, some things that have the label AI slapped on them may not be, you know, true machine learning-based systems, but simply sophisticated algorithms. But calling it AI does not create this law-free zone. You are not somehow exempt from the rules of accountability and non-discrimination that apply. And we also took a bit of a deep dive on the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the statute which you know very well, Stephanie, and a statute that has obviously been quite controversial over the years as applied to security researchers. Again, recent guidance on that from the Supreme Court in the Van Buren case, recent guidance on that from the Department of Justice, saying that it will not seek to prosecute good faith security researchers. On the other hand, fairly aggressive use in many respects of that authority by the U.S. Department of Justice against nation state actors and ransomware, et cetera. So we said it's just too early to legislate. and particularly with the CFAA, any changes to that could have wide-reaching ramifications and all kinds of unintended consequences and throw us back into the stew of what's legitimate research and how should good faith security researchers be treated. We decided we just cannot open that can of worms now. It's just premature. The existing laws, including the Federal Trade Commission Act's unfair and deceptive practices prohibition, as well as the anti-discrimination laws, as well as arguably the False Claims Act in terms of systems provided to the government under government contracts. All of those laws, let's just work with them, apply them. They more or less work, sort of with an emphasis more on the more working than less working. And at the end of the day, we did say that the enforcement agencies, the regulatory agencies, do need to continue to clarify how AI-based security concerns fit into their existing regulatory structures, but just not the kind of thing that Congress can, at this point, have much meaningful to offer. And so we recommend it against any changes, particularly to the CFAA, but even more broadly, we said we're not ready to say what an AI security law would look like, assuming you even want an AI security law as opposed to, again, a cybersecurity law.
So I very much take the point on the problems and challenges with trying to extend the CFAA to cover AI-based attacks per se. But you do talk about in the report extending and adapting cybersecurity law to address AI vulnerabilities. And it seemed to me that while looking at this approach, you simultaneously recognize that, you know, cybersecurity law was still in flux. And so there are some inherent challenges here.
Absolutely. No. We have this beautiful sentence here. Just as AI fits, albeit uneasily, within traditional cybersecurity risk frameworks, so also it is covered under existing law, but in ways and to a degree the courts and regulators have not yet fully clarified. So, but, you know, that's not unlike the industrial control systems that Jono refers to. It's not unlike traditional software. We do have an evolving set of laws, you know, some of them common law doctrines dating back centuries, laws of negligence and contract. We have the early 20th century unfair and deceptive trade practices laws. Now we have a sort of a new generation of requirements. We have the word reasonable in 24 state laws, reasonable cybersecurity measures. We have the FTC enforcement, et cetera. But our overarching point was, as that cybersecurity crazy quilt is being stitched together, let's not assume we have to start stitching together a separate quilt of laws for AI. Let's start with the assumption. And by the way, that's sort of been my approach to tech policy, tech law generally. Start with the assumption that your existing laws work. Start by figuring out how to fit any new problem into the existing frameworks. And then only when it's clear that adjustment is needed do you act. And right now, it's still, to me, and I think to the others on this report, there's still no clear need to develop a separate set of laws for AI.
So, Jim, while the working group was meeting and, you know, engaging in discussions that led to this report, I know you're familiar with the fact that the Biden administration was in the process of developing the National Cybersecurity Strategy that ended up being released in March of this year, you know, relatively shortly before this report was issued. And we learned in the National Cybersecurity Strategy that the Biden administration believes we should be developing new liability standards for software and more broadly be looking to shift responsibility onto those entities who are in the best position to secure our software and our systems. How might all of that touch upon or perhaps not touch upon AI security?
Well, again, exactly. And going back to our theme, that law or set of policy, legal changes that address the question of software liability, that should be done with an eye to AI. But as John said, as we say in our report, AI products are software. And whatever we develop for software in general, and however we choose to define the standard of care, the first hurdle, and you've written about this for Lawfare, Stephanie, the first hurdle that we need to cross in to get to the promised land that's envisioned in the national strategy, the first hurdle is defining what is the standard of care. How do we define what is good enough software? Jono said, we don't expect, and we're never going to get a perfectly secure software, whether it's AI-based or otherwise. We're never going to get to perfection, so we're looking at something less than perfection. How do we define that? So far, we've come up with one word, reasonable, reasonably secure, reasonable technical, administrative, and physical measures to protect systems. So how do we define the standard of care? As we do that, in the course of addressing the software liability problem writ large, we need to keep in mind software systems. But I don't think need or want, and it would be a nightmare, to try to have one software liability standard for AI software and one software liability standard for all other software, because they're increasingly just one and the same thing.
Fair enough. I appreciate that we've been going a bit out of order of the report's recommendations, but I don't want to leave out the second topic of recommendations, which is improving information sharing and organizational security mindsets. And so I wanted to know whether and why, if it is, why is it difficult to assess how large the threat of attacks are on AI systems?
Well, Stephanie, I mean, I know this sort of goes across some of the recommendations. And I was actually thinking that maybe recommendation 2.2 might be my favorite, which is not exactly, it's part of assessment, right? Without a security culture, without a real commitment to sort of build security in from the beginning, to build both incident management, which includes detection as well as reporting, but also vulnerability management, which includes detection, triage, reporting, and then broader communication structures, industry or trade groups, or just groups where like-minded people with similar problems can share their security issues in a trusted space, becomes quite hard to assess what's going on. In traditional security assessments, you know, the first thing that happens is you have to start looking for the problems before you can assess how bad they are. And it's unclear to us as the workshop went on, it's unclear if there's a regular, regimented sort of way that people are looking and then assessing, reporting, right? We talk a little bit in the report about the AI incident database. Incident to the cybersecurity community always means sort of computer security incident. And there's a whole set of structures around computer security incident reporting and response. That's what a CERT is, computer security incident response team, a team of people who do computer security incident response. But with the AI database, that community is looking more at sort of safety, fairness, robustness failures, which are obviously important and maybe are safety failures. But incident is used in a different way. And I know that I keep coming back to sort of terminology, and maybe that sounds a bit in the weeds. But of course, it's quite hard to communicate about how bad something is if one community is using one word in one way and another community is using exactly the same word but in a different way. That's exactly how we're going to end up with communication, sort of at cross purposes where we think we understand each other, but we're actually talking about different things. And I think that's why it's so hard to assess the state of affairs right now. The ML engineering and AI engineering communities have developed some of their own terms. Some of them overlap with the cybersecurity community for sure. Maybe Jim can talk about whether they overlap with the policy community. He's a much more well-versed in that than I am. But what I have recognized and what the report talks about a little bit is these spaces where communication is hard, not because the experts aren't attempting to talk, although they aren't maybe talking quite as much as the report thinks we, you know, maybe they should be, but also where the terms being discussed are not just not connecting, but they're crossed in a way that sort of causes miscommunication. So that's why this whole topic area around improving information sharing is not just about getting people in one room, which of course it is, but it's also about driving sort of genuine communication, genuine connection on topics of importance, like really harmonizing what we mean by our processes and the operational aspects of like how some terms get cashed out into what we actually do differently. And that's going to be quite a challenge, but I think it's something that the communities are definitely, you know, they're up for, they have the skills for. It's important. It's important that they're encouraged to do it. That definitely gets at why it's so hard.
In the context of improving information sharing and organizational security mindsets, I think the report makes an important point that in the context of high-risk AI systems, it's really important for developers and deployers to prioritize transparency. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think that the first question does this particular product have AI capabilities built into it? What are they? We're actually at Stanford working on a paper on how to apply the SBOM, Software Bill of Materials, concept to artificial intelligence. And just as we argue in this report here, that the concept of vulnerabilities, vulnerability management, the cataloging of vulnerabilities through the Common Vulnerabilities and Exposure CVE system, that these should encompass and include AI vulnerabilities. A lot flows from sort of getting a CVE number. So also, we don't say it in this report, but we're about to say it in another report coming out of Stanford, that the SBOM concept can be applied to artificial intelligence-based products so that things like what was the training data set that was used, what was the basic methodology used for the training. These are kinds of things that increasingly should be disclosed, and that the adopters of AI, the sort of people at the end of the supply chain that Jono referred to, should begin demanding and should understand how to interpret and should know what to do with and should be able to read an SBOM for an AI-based system and be able to see what are the risks that they're taking on board. Because again, increasingly, every industry, every sector across multiple kinds of operations, both internal as well as consumer-facing, as well as Jono said, the whole ICS, industrial control system, physical computer interface world, AI is going to be in all of those things. And people adopting software products, implementing things into their systems, need to have a way to know what are the risks that they're taking on board. And that's, to my mind, what transparency is all about.
So is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners?
Well, just stay tuned. This is an extremely rapidly developing field. The amount that has happened since we convened our workshop last summer and today is just remarkable. We talked at the workshop last year about reconvening, and I think that's on us, but I'm hoping we can get folks together for one or more follow-on discussions and follow-on reports, and basically try to keep ratcheting up the awareness and the shared knowledge around these issues. AI is here to stay. It clearly has huge benefits, but it comes with risks. And everything we know about security, just like everything we know about privacy, but everything we know about security says you have to build it in from the outset. You can't bolt it on afterwards.
Jono?
I obviously agree with Jim on this. The thing that I really feel is important out of a lot of this topic is that AI systems can learn a lot from what we know about building and securing software systems. There are going to be nuances that are important that we need to figure out the answers to what the exact best process is, but that the machine learning engineering community, the policy community, the cybersecurity community should work together on communicating what building security in, because that's not just the process of you build the system and then you let it out into the world. Building security in means all of the processes for being transparent about the problems as they arise, for managing the vulnerabilities as they arise, for responsibly communicating with people who need to know what your development decisions were so that you can be transparent about it and people can make their asset management decisions, their usage decisions. And I look forward to continued development in this space where those three communities really come together and build a really great understanding of what it means to build security into AI systems through vulnerability management, transparency, all of the things that we talk about in the report.
Well, thank you both so much for joining me.
Thanks, Stephanie. Really great. Thanks, Jono.
Yeah, thank you both very much.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.